NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant-making, leadership training, and convening. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.npr.org, where you can hear today's program at your convenience. The special Main Street Flood website, Remembering and Rebuilding, also includes entries from a flood journal and photos of the people and places we're talking about today. The entire collection of NPR stories on the flood will also be available on the Main Street website. The address again is www.npr.org.
It's a big, big flood.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this special Main Street Radio broadcast live from East Grand Forks. The music we're listening to is part of a theatrical production, Keep the Faith, written and performed by the people of this area in commemoration of the big flood. A year ago, they were fighting the battle of their lives against the relentless Red River. After days of sandbagging and pumping, the river flowed over its dikes and through the streets of Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. Homes and schools and businesses were washed away. Among the hardest hit areas was a close-knit neighborhood of comfortable older homes and middle-class families in East Central Grand Forks. For the residents who lived on or near Lincoln Drive, the flood took more than their homes and belongings. It stole a sense of community that may never be replaced. Minnesota Public Radio's Laura McCullum tells the stories of three families from the Lincoln Drive neighborhood and how they're rebuilding their lives after the flood.
On April 22, 1997, thousands of people chased from their homes by the surging Red River pressed into a hangar at the Grand Forks Air Force Base to hear President Clinton offer words of comfort and support.
We have hardly ever seen such a remarkable demonstration of courage and commitment and cooperation and basic human strength, and we are very impressed and proud to be Americans when we see what you have done in the face of this tragedy.
In the audience, three neighbors listened: John Little, Pat Moen, and Susan Cutchall. All lived within a few blocks of one another. All three fled Grand Forks as the Red River spilled over dikes and poured into their homes after rising high above National Weather Service projections to crest at 54 feet, 26 feet above flood stage. The Moens and Cutchalls lived on Lincoln Drive, their backyards bordering the river. John Little's house stood a couple of blocks away on Chestnut. There was a sense of comfort, even relief, in the airbase hangar, a huge change from the confusion and terror described in the pages of Susan Cutchall's diary in the days leading up to the president's visit.
April 17, 97. It happened in the afternoon. The dike had four cracks at the end of Lincoln Drive. Siren blew. Police came, guards, fire trucks, helicopters, and I broke down. We packed clothes and cleared off the refrigerator and went over to 207 Chestnut, where we thought we would be safe. 1:15 Friday, we heard on the radio that the Lincoln gave in. It's going up. Lincoln Lagoon, they call it. We walked all the way home, not knowing what to expect. Two houses from us, you can see the water coming up. Cheers. Fell down my cheeks, and the guard stopped us, and I said, no, that's our house. I got up at 4:30 Friday. The sirens are going off, the phones are ringing. The woman I was staying with, Mary Ann Allen, woke me up and said that was a call for prayer. We did. And all I could do is imagine everybody praying to God to stop these waters. Because we can't. We tried. We went through town very, very slow, creepy. We were still scared because if that engine stalled, we're right in the middle of it. We thought we were going to air base. Instead, we went to Faith Community Church on the other side, and we thought we were safe. We got up at 7 a.m. to find out the water's getting closer and closer. So here we are, doing it again. And we went for shelter at the airbase. And I told my husband, if it comes out this far, I'm leaving the whole state. I've had enough. I can't run away anymore.
By the time President Clinton toured Grand Forks, the Cutchalls and their neighbor, John Little, had been staying on canvas cots at the base for 3 days. Little, a wiry man with a shock of curly hair, moved to Grand Forks in 1969, but you'd never know it to hear his southern accent. The University of North Dakota English professor fully expected to be at the base another week or two.
I don't think the river's going to be going down much in a week. And I do enjoy visiting. And I'm enjoying watching the people, but it would be nice to take a shower.
Little had heard the gurgle of his basement filling the night before he evacuated, and like many at the base, he wasn't sure what condition his home would be in when he returned. But Pat Moen already knew floodwaters reached the rooftop of her two-story home. Her husband, a Grand Forks police officer, patrolled the area. Moen knew they would not return to 501 Lincoln Drive.
It's hard. In Lincoln Drive area, that whole neighborhood is a real close neighborhood. So, it's hard.
Three weeks later, mid-May, Moen's neighborhood is deserted. The only sound, a wind chime still hanging in her backyard. Some nearby homes were forced off their foundations by the force of the floodwater. Moen's blue 75-year-old home is marked off by yellow police tape. Inside, floors have buckled, half-dried mud is peeling off the kitchen counters, and her refrigerator is toppled over. Moen can't spend any time there. The home's musty flood smell brings on her asthma. At a restaurant on the other side of town, Moen says her neighborhood is destroyed.
And I look at my neighbor's houses and I cry. It's hard.
It's quiet in Grand Forks, now that the Red River is back within its banks. As residents returned to their homes in the days following the flood, many directed their anger at the National Weather Service for its inaccurate prediction of the river's crest. An army of volunteers is still helping with disaster relief in Grand Forks, but the satellite farms of the TV crews have withered away almost to nothing, and the visits by national politicians have stopped. Pat Moen and her husband Jim are staying with her mother in a two-bedroom trailer. They've decided to move to North Carolina, where their daughter lives, when Jim retires from the police department in January. The Cutchalls, who lived a few blocks away on higher ground, are renting a rundown trailer in nearby Amarillo, not sure whether to clean up their house, which got about a foot of water on the main floor, or wait for a possible buyout. Both the Moens and Cutchalls' homes are on what's called the wet or wrong side of a proposed new dike city officials are considering to protect Grand Forks from future floods, although it isn't likely to be built for several years. Only John Little is living in his home again.
So what you say?
When Little's small, dark basement flooded, a brick wall caved in, but the water didn't reach his main floor. Little knows he was fortunate, but he did spend a miserable 5 days pumping out his basement without the benefit of heat, running water, or electricity.
That might have been one of the worst weeks of my life, working in that dungeon with that muck. And there's no easy way, no way to glamorize what it was like in that basement. You know, I had a Coleman lantern and a flashlight and a squeegee board and a push broom and a 5-gallon bucket so that you were just hauling that muck out of there.
Little is glad to be back in his two-story home, which he's been restoring for more than a decade. One of his teenage twin sons lives here, too. The 58-year-old English professor has long planned to stay until he retires to his home state of Mississippi in a few years. He admits he's second-guessed himself a few times, not because of the flood, but because he didn't apply soon enough to get any of the so-called angel money. An anonymous donor pledged $15 million to Grand Forks flood victims to be distributed in no-strings-attached $2,000 grants. Little says he put off applying because he hates filling out forms and standing in line. And now the money's gone.
Everything that the city said and that I heard through the grapevine led me to believe that you didn't have to rush to get the money. I thought it was kind of guaranteed. So I felt like they had misled me, and that made me better enough I'm ashamed to say that I thought, I don't want to be here anymore. But I've since backed off of that, you know, now that you have time to think about
it. Little is also working on a novel about, ironically, North Dakotans who lost their homes to a reservoir. It's early July, nearly 3 months after the flood. Lincoln Drive is still devastated. Little has changed here, except now a few barren lots are evidence Grand Forks has begun tearing down houses. The city council has approved the first phase of a plan to buy out flood-damaged homes. Officials delayed a decision until Congress approved a disaster relief bill allocating more than $1 billion to Minnesota and the Dakotas. The latest damage estimate for Grand Forks alone is more than $500 million. The Cutchalls have decided to buy a new house 17 miles away in Amarillo, far from the flood-prone river. Sitting in front of 7 Lincoln Drive, Dennis Cutchall is resigned to leaving the place they called home for almost a decade and a half.
That's what kept us here in the neighborhood. And I guess that's finally what's making us decide to leave, because the neighborhood's going to be gone. Even if our house stayed, the neighborhood's gone. It's an old-fashioned type of neighborhood where you could sit out and wave at people, and kids would play on their bikes and everything. So that's going to be tough to leave that.
Good afternoon. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're continuing this Main Street broadcast live from East Grand Forks. We're broadcasting from the City Council chambers here, just a block from the Red River. And in the council chambers with me this afternoon, we have John Little and Dennis and Susan Cutchall. Pat Moen is joining us from station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
You all lived in the same part of Grand Forks, and you all lost your homes in last year's flood. But a year after the flood, you've made very different decisions about what direction to go. Dennis and Susan, you have stayed in the area but moved 17 miles out of Grand Forks. And John, your house is going to be bought out, but at this point, you remain there. Pat, you and your husband moved across the country to North Carolina. Let's talk about why you decided to do what you did. Pat, was it more painful to stay than to leave?
I think it was. We have our daughter and our grandkids here in Kannapolis, and we had to make the decision whether to come and be with them or try to find a place that was like Lincoln Drive in Grand Forks. It was a like close neighborhood. It was hard to see us all go in different directions, not knowing where any of our neighbors were going. We wanted to be close to them, but I also wanted to be close to my daughter and my grandchildren.
As you've moved now across the country to North Carolina and the rebuilding goes on here, do you keep up with it quite closely, or do you try to forget about it?
You can't forget about friends, a neighborhood, and what's happened to them. You will never forget them.
Dennis and Susan, let's talk about, did you also toy with the idea of just moving? I mean, you had a lot of options, I suppose, when your house is taken.
Oh, yes. We did think about leaving real quick. And well, in the other half, why would we be running away? I mean, you can't run away from the weather. It's going to strike you wherever you are. So, and that's how I looked at it. So.
And we, just as Pat said, she has grandkids down there. We have grandkids up here in Grand Forks and the son and daughter. So we still have connections here. Plus, we still like Grand Forks, you know, and we work here, volunteer here.
Why Amarillo?
we were going by what was available. Grand Forks obviously had a severe housing problem right after the flood. And with what the SBA was willing to loan us, what we could put together, that just happened to be the correct choice. It fell into the right range.
Will Amaretto ever be home to you?
No. No.
Pat said she couldn't have Lincoln Park again. She couldn't have the neighborhood back. So do you just settle for something else, basically?
Well, when you've lived at Lincoln Drive for 12 and a half years, even if you've been bought out, we still consider that us our home. It was our first home we bought. And all of our kids grew up there. Our youngest was 2 years old, and now she's 15. And so, you know, and being ex-military, we're only used to being in one state for 3 or 4 years at a time.
So this is where you put down your roots.
Right, right.
Lincoln Park.
Lincoln Drive.
Lincoln Drive.
There is a big difference, because there is a Lincoln Park.
Yeah, there is a big difference.
John, you remain there.
Yeah, I'm still living in my house. And I'll be there as long as the city will let me stay there. But eventually I will retire. I hope to retire in Oxford, Mississippi.
Does it seem so odd to still be there?
No, I like my house. You know, I got a house with hardwood floors and a fireplace and a bay window and an upstairs. And I do, it's the only house I ever own, really. So I think of it as home. I just wish it were not quite so close to the Red River of the North. I wish it were in Oxford, Mississippi. I wish it were where I could, I'd love to move that house down to Oxford when I retire. I leave this afternoon, about an hour from now, actually, to fly to Oxford and try to look for a house. Hopefully I can find one this weekend, and with the SBA's help, buy it. I don't know that that's going to happen, but hopefully it will. Oxford is, I've always felt like, I went to school in Ole Miss in the 50s, and I spent a couple of sabbaticals there.
So you have strong ties there.
Yeah, so it's a home away from home for me. So I look forward to going there.
I drove down Lincoln Drive yesterday. And a year after the flood, in some sense, it looks like the waters could have receded last week. Still homes there, broken windows, a lot of destruction still standing there. Do you go back? Dennis, do you drive back through there?
I used to drive back when we still had the house. I drove back every day, but I find myself driving through there maybe once a week or so, and I guess as a check, see if the house is still standing and see what's going on down there. We haven't completely been able to make that break yet.
I wasn't prepared for the homes turned into billboards that I saw when I drove through there last night. Sightseers go home.
Well,
time.
Rachel,
tear this house
think,
down and yeah. die.
I think, Rachel, you had to be there.
Obviously, a lot of anger, a sense of betrayal on the part of people. Do you sense that, John, as you continue to live there? Is it like a ghost town? Certainly, there are houses that are inhabited very close to the blocks where houses are deserted.
Well, my neighborhood is still there. Unlike Lincoln Drive, you know.
You were a couple blocks off.
Yeah. My next-door neighbor is leaving at the end of this month, and they were very close friends. They are going to Maple Lake. And I will miss them a lot. So that's going to be a major blow when they leave.
But my neighbor on the other side is going to be there when I'm gone. There will be a slight gap or two in my neighborhood, but nothing like the destruction that was in Lincoln Drive. So we don't have the kind of trauma that Dennis and Susan experienced.
Our phone lines are open this afternoon. If you would like to call us during this special Main Street broadcast on the flood, you can do that at 1-800-537-5252. We have Denise from Minneapolis on the phone. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. It's good to hear this program. We've been, like many Twin Cities residents, I have Grand Forks roots and grew up and spent some time on Lincoln Drive and went to Lincoln Elementary. So I've been sad to hear the fate of the street. And that was my original question is the Lincoln Drive neighborhood, is Lincoln Drive gone? Is it anything going to be rebuilt? Is everybody going to be dispersed forever? And then an unrelated question is, what is the role that neighborhoods are playing to help rebuild themselves? Here in the Twin Cities, we have a neighborhood revitalization program where people are active and empowered to help make decisions in revitalizing and rebuilding neighborhoods. And is that kind of a thing playing out at all in Grand Forks? And then I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. Let's take the first part of your question. Susan, are those homes on Lincoln Drive all coming down?
Yes, they are. And besides that, like both of the mayors, they're both deciding where the dikes are going to be. Even our neighbors, which is right on Amonte, they have to leave too. And because the dike is coming right through the living room. So,
as I understand it, from federal guidelines, they can't rebuild residents there. They can only make it a greenway or parking lots.
Would you live there again if they said to you today, the call came in and they said, Dennis and Susan, we'll build your exact house just like it was right there on your same lot? Would you say, okay, we're coming back from Amarillo? Or would you say, I can never live there again?
I think there are a lot of days when we would say, yeah.
We're coming back. And then there's those others.
When we think of the water coming over the dike, and it's like, whoa,
it'd be very hard to go back. I mean, nothing is going to be the same ever again. Once you leave, it's hard to go back because you want it to be like it was before the flood, and it can't be because everything has changed.
Pat, how would you respond to that? If they said they could take your house and fix it up as good as new, would you come home? Pat, have we still got you on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina?
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah,
I can hear you. Yeah, I probably would if I could talk my daughter to come home. I miss it, my friends. I miss the neighborhood. And to answer one of Denise's questions, I wish people could see how bad Lincoln Drive really looks. The signs on the houses, as you commented about, you had to be there. It was bad enough to lose your house. Then you had people going through your house, taking what they wanted, and you're standing in there being violated, and people got angry. It's hard to explain it. It's a very hurt feeling.
I read the article in the paper about people arrested for looting in these houses and people trying to burglarize what's left. At that point, did you feel like choking somebody?
Yeah.
Was there a sense, Dennis, of like, this, come on?
Actually, that was one of the reasons we moved so quickly to buy another house, because through the help of a lot of people that came and helped us, we saved much of our stuff, and we felt we had to get it out of there as soon as possible.
Do you wonder when you're going to get over this? This is a year now since the flood. Would you have thought a year ago, boy, if I could just get through this year, then life is going to be happy and we're all going to smile again? Or is there, a year later, is there a sense, gee, it's not moving quite as quickly as I would have liked it to, at least on an emotional front? Susan, how would you answer that?
That's a good question. Sometimes I think it goes fast because I volunteer for a child daycare center, and I have a good news at the house twice a week, Good News Club, to teach children about God. And it goes real fast, but, you know, as far as, I still sit down and write 7 Lincoln Drive, and I still write the old phone number, 775-5036. You know, and after all these years of doing that, it's hard to, you know, it's not as, it's easier to switch from 97 to 98 than it is from living somewhere for, it's going to take a long time, you know. We still have things in our house, in our new house, that still have flood water all over them. I haven't even gotten a chance to clean them yet. Besides that, I've noticed a lot about flood water. No matter how many times you clean it, it comes back. There's a film that will not be erased. And I think that's the way it is with our lives today from Grand Forks. It's a film that will never be erased. It will always be there. Whether you have adjusted, to me, you won't recover 100%. Maybe 98, but that 2% is still there. It's like memories.
When Mayor Pat Owens was on this morning, she talked about we will be stronger, we will be better, we won't be the same, but we'll be different.
Yeah.
Do you have to at some point think it can't be the same, it can't be the same, quit wishing it could be the same? Do you have to almost mentally shake yourself and think, okay, turn around and look forward now?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. We have to think things won't be the old normal, they have to be the new normal. It's
a whole new continuum then.
Right.
John, do you agree with this?
Yeah, I look forward to the time that I'm going to go to Oxford, Mississippi, and live. I think that's the way that my chapter is going to be closed on it. I don't think that's going to happen real soon. You know, I don't know when I'm going to be able to retire. I'm going to retire as soon as I can, but that's still 3 or 4 years, I think, down the road. But I'm going to leave a couple of boys who consider Grand Forks home here. I expect to be coming back in the summer times and going fishing. A lot of my favorite fishing holes are in this state, Minnesota and Manitoba. So I expect to be commuting back here in the summertime. But the flood is going to be behind me. There is going to be no residue and no film on my soul. Maybe I'm lucky that way. I saw the flood as a massive inconvenience to me personally, but I never cried over anything that I lost. I didn't have to. So I consider myself lucky. I don't know how my life is going to be in Oxford. I don't know that I can find a house there. You don't ever know that.
So you don't know what the future holds for
you. I don't know what the future holds, and I'm still in a state of chaos because I don't know how long I'm going to be in my home, when I'm going to sell it. All of that is still in the future. But the Red River, when it retreated from my life after I got back in it, all that it did was inconvenience me.
Our phone lines are open this afternoon, 1-800-537-5252. I'm Rachel Reby, and this is a special Main Street Radio broadcast from East Grand Forks. We have Dennis and Susan Kutchel with us here, as well as John Little. Pat Mullen joins us from station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Denise Tuohy is a psychologist and professor at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Dr. Tuohy, welcome to our show today. I want to ask you about, let's talk about these stress scales that we're going to be on and how are you ranking on the stress scale. What does a flood that chases 61,000 people out of their homes, what does that do on the stress scale?
Well, I think it puts you about off the charts because so many of the things that people have been talking about already today are separate items on the stress scale, losing a home, losing a job, conflict in relationships. We've seen a huge increase in domestic violence, for example. People at our university clinic have been coming in more often for relational difficulties, couples therapy. Children, I guess, have been extremely traumatized. And as parents are traumatized, re-traumatized by trying to help their children. And there's just a whole host of things that set one another off.
Are men and women, do they deal very differently with this? We just heard Susan say, there will always be a film from the flood on my life. Then John Little, sitting across the table, said, there will be no film in my life from the flood. Is that not a typical, but is that not an unusual difference in how people look? Is there a difference in the sexes, or is it just difference of personality?
Well, I studied gender. That's my primary research interest, and I was kind of smiling to myself, and actually I looked over and saw a student from our program sitting back there, and I winked at her when I was listening to John Little talk, because he does seem to kind of portray, it is a stereotype, but in some ways it's also a very real portrayal of what a lot of the gender differences in this community have looked like. I wrote an article on coping with the flood, gender differences. I was talking about men mainly, and how they're kind of fallen heroes in a sense. I heard the word hero also a lot throughout this broadcast. You know, we as community, we're all heroes. But men are heroes in a different way in a disaster. And I think some of your coping skills are different, John, than mine, for example. I mean, although you speak painfully about what pumping out the basement was like for you, I think that it taps many more insecurities in me or in Pat just because I haven't been socialized to know how to do those things. So when I see men, you know, rushing in with hammers and nails and pumps and equipment and duct tape, I I have to laugh at Marcia Harris's article in the Herald because she said, a flood is a guy thing. You know, and in some ways, a natural disaster gives men something to do that they've historically always been good at doing.
So men and women do deal very differently.
Well, that's, yes, I think so. And I did have kind of a reaction from some men who read this article of mine saying, what am I trying to say, that it's healthy to cry? But yes, and I mean, we know from, you know, studying grief literature, and a flood in a way is a grief process. Coping with a natural disaster is a grief process. And when I hear you talking about going back to your house and saying goodbye, it's you're lucky that, I mean, I don't want to say you're lucky, of course none of us are lucky, but the physical remains is there and you can say goodbye, and I think that's a very healthy coping mechanism. And I think often men don't cry.
You know, I used to find that I didn't lose anything in the flood that made me cry. And that's a fact.
John, you've lived there how long?
I think 14 years.
So you still live there along. It's not like you sound like you might have arrived yesterday from Mississippi, but you haven't. You lived here for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I've been in the community for maybe 30 years. I had an accent when I came.
I'm sure.
Most of it is gone. some of it is gone. I do, you know, I have noticed that I don't sleep as much. I keep books on my bed now. And I often will read two or three times during the course of a night. That may be a function of stress. I don't know. I don't consciously feel like I'm suffering a whole lot, nor have suffered, you know, those god-awful days when you had to spend hours on the telephone trying to find somebody to put a lights in or put an electric box in. Or
so a lot of frustrations, a lot of things to get upset about.
A lot of that. But I just, I feel like there is no permanent scars from the flood for me. But I didn't lose what a lot of people lost, you know. I'm going to lose my house, and I'm going to miss it, but it's not going to make me cry, you know.
This program is coming to you live from East Grand Forks, their brand new city council chambers. Main Street's Dan Gunderson is with somebody in the audience with a question or comment. Dan?
Yes, Linda is a Grand Forks resident. She moved here just in time for the flood, she says, and she has a question for Denise Dewey.
Hi, I've read some of your articles about different responses that genders have, you know, the intimacy thing. And those of us who are in the mental health field in this area have noticed a real dramatic increase in the number of couples coming in for counseling. I'm wondering if you could comment on that, if you think it's related to the way people are coping with the flood.
That's a good question. I think that some of the differences that we've just been talking about create those conflicts in relationship. For example, John, if you were married and your wife was crying every day and telling you about all the things that she lost, and you're saying over and over again, well, you know, I didn't lose anything, you might have quite a bit more tension than you would have before the flood. And so I think sometimes the differences in coping styles can cause those conflicts, and a natural disaster really brings those out.
Pat, let's ask you, you and your husband, have you reacted very differently to the flood and how your lives have changed as a result of the flood?
We had to act different. Butch had to be on top of Lincoln Drive, watch his house go underwater, stop his neighbors from going into the neighborhood at times. So I didn't cry a lot in front of him. I held it back to be strong for him. But in the same breath, I always knew if I had to cry, he would be there. We're strong for each other. We work well together as a couple, and we've had our cry together, but it's been in North Carolina. It wasn't in Grand Forks. We, like I said, we miss our neighbors, our friends. Butch was a police officer for 31 and a half years, so he's had a lot of public contact, a lot of friends that we had left behind.
So the pain of that as well. We've spent much of our show talking with adults about how the flood has impacted them, how they're putting their lives back together. What about the children, though? How are they coping? One of the elementary schools destroyed by the flood was in the Lincoln neighborhood, where John Little, Pat Moen, and the Cutchells all lived. The children of Lincoln Elementary School, now relocated to a church building, created a book of poems about their flood experience. Let's listen to how some of the children remember the flood.
Before the flood, my school was happy. There was always at least one kid hanging around after school, but now it was deserted, lonely, and sad. When I saw my school, it was so lonely. A swing was swaying back and forth really slow, with a little squeak each time it went back and forth. The doors were chained up, making it look eerie. It looked like no one had ever been at our school for years. It's like the end of all those memories. I tasted fruit roll-ups when I was evacuated. I heard about the fire. People were worried and serious. I had to be evacuated twice. I felt nervous. I was embarrassed when I went walking in puddles with my uncle and my boots got stuck twice. One boot came off right in the middle of a puddle and I couldn't balance, so I put my foot in the mud. I had to take a shower and change my socks. My dad said that the water would never trickle to our house, but I know now that even though people say things, it's not always true, and that water can change a person's life so much. I evacuated to Valley City. I was worried as I thought about if our house was drowning. I was worried as I thought about if there was anything to come back to. I was worried as I combed my hair to go to Washington Elementary. In my stomach, it felt like a bomb was exploding. My legs felt like they were in the next room.
When we got home from evacuation, we had to clean. Clean the basement that smelled like mold and old gloppy gunk. We also had to chip the tile off the basement floor. When the hammer struck, the floor went kerplunk. The Red Cross food was kind of gross. It tasted like old dried out things. I looked around, and on berms there were piles and piles of old flooded stuff. I picked up some mud. It was like mashed potatoes and applesauce. I saw my skull get torn down. I felt like crying, but I did not. I could talk forever and ever, but I will not.
The hardest things to throw away were my stuffed animals. Before the flood, my stuffed animals felt soft and furry. My favorite one was my cuddly Mickey Mouse. All of my stuffed animals looked so neat together. They always smelled fresher than fresh. Then the flood came. All of my toys were wiped out. They felt sticky and gooey. All of my stuffed animals looked like brown pieces of junk. Floods are more destructive than I thought. It's hard to get through them. People put their heads down, cup their faces with their hands, and sob.
Again, those are the children of the Lincoln Elementary School with poems that they have written about the flood. Dr. Tu, you're a psychologist, a professor at University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Your reaction to some of the comments of the children?
Well, I wrote down a few of the comments while I was listening because they were so powerful, the images. The one was about the house was drowning. And I think that's a typical thing that children will do, is to make inanimate objects into people, and then they can talk about what that feels like and how that house must feel. But I noticed that little girl didn't really want to talk about how she felt, and I was concerned about that. She said she would not cry, and she could cry all day, but she won't. She could talk all day, but she won't. And I thought this could be a problem. I think she's getting socialized into the same system that John Little was brought up with, and I think she could have some difficulties later.
So as adults, people need to encourage children to talk about it, to
right.
think about it. I mean, even this elementary school, that they are writing poems about it. They put together a quilt about the flood. Those sorts of things help?
Oh, absolutely. Those creative activities that give the children a chance to express themselves, maybe non-verbally if they can't talk, but help them to acknowledge that there has been a change in their life. I also think it's very important how parents talk to them about the flood and to validate their feelings. And like if they are feeling sad or if they miss their house or if they feel like they want to go home, even if they're in a new home that just feels like a house so far. Pat, your comment reminded me of the daughter of one of my colleagues who every now and then says she has to go home because her new house isn't home yet.
Susan, you and Dennis have a daughter that still lives at home. Has it been hard when you are in this totally traumatic situation and have all the economic worries and the insurance and the buyout and the angel fund and all those things going on and your own grief and pain? How do you then have anything left over to help the people you love get through it?
I would say we pray a lot. I think God has provided all at all ends, before and after and during, you know. And even our own daughter, she has no reflection on the flood, and that worries me because it needs to get out as soon as possible because burying this isn't going to help. And she doesn't say much, you know.
She's at an age where they wouldn't talk anyway, though, isn't your daughter?
14 now. Well, I just turned 15, yeah.
So whether she'd been through a flood or not, she probably still wouldn't be talking to her parents as much as
right.
she would to her peers.
Mm-hmm.
When she moved, was she able to stay in the same school or the same group of friends? Or is
she
that...
did for 6 months. She went to Central. And first time ever in Central. So basically now she's going to Larimore School, Beam Bus. And she likes it there, still learning new friends. But she's still keeping her old friends, because, you know, just like Pat Moen's daughter was our other older daughter's friend. And they've been friends since 12, 15 years.
So the families in the neighborhood are very
right.
tied together as well.
Yes.
Denise, have you seen lots of children come in for counseling? Have the counseling services here been overwhelmed with the response, or is there something about Scandinavian farmers that don't take well to counseling?
Well, actually, both of those are true. I think initially people didn't have time to go to counseling because they were too busy just trying to put their electricity back and the furnace and so forth. But recently, there's been a surprising increase in mental health services in the area. Northeast Human Services was expecting their caseload to start decreasing now, but instead it's on the increase. Domestic violence has gone up 47% in this community. I tried to find out about substance abuse, and although the hospital doesn't, the number of admissions isn't a good way to try to assess what that kind of problem looks like, but alcohol sales have increased considerably in this community, and I think that all kind of goes together and makes sense, that people are coping in a lot of different ways and sometimes not in the healthiest ways.
Do you see clearly the different stages of going through this? You know, we talk about the bargaining, the anger, the denial. This isn't a death situation, but in a way it is a death situation.
Right. Well, people in the trauma literature have their own stages. There are four of them, the hero stage, the disillusionment stage, the anger, and then rebuilding. And I heard Pat Owen say this morning that she feels as a community we're in the anger stage.
So almost through.
Almost through, but, you know, it takes 1 to 3 years probably. And as I mentioned before, individuals don't go through these stages in necessarily the same ways. Men and women might not go through the stages in the same ways.
We are out of time. Pat Moen, Dennis and Susan Cutchell, John Little, thank you for sharing your lives with us. Denise Tuohy, thanks for joining us today as well. This special Main Street Radio broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineer today is Rick Hobzinski on location and Randy Johnson in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer. Dan Gunderson is the field producer. Executive producers Mel Summer and Kate Smith. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street Radio team is Leif Enger, Dan Gunderson, Mark Stile, Catherine Winter, and myself, Rachel Reby. We also invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.mpr.org. You can hear this program on the Main Street website and see the photographs that go along with it, as well as other Main Street reports. You can also send us your comments and suggestions via email. The address again, www.mpr.org. NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant-making, leadership training, and convening. We close this special two-hour Main Street broadcast with a piece of music written by J. Robert Hansen to commemorate the flood. Hansen lived on the Red River for 27 years in Moorhead, where he taught at Concordia College and conducted the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony. Commissioned by the Grand Forks Schools, the piece premiered last week, performed by the combined bands of Grand Forks Central and Red River High Schools. The composer's program notes explain the piece opens with quiet percussion. Clarinets provide a steady rhythm intended to represent the constant flow of the river. The intensity grows with woodwinds, percussion, and brass, reaching a climax midway through the piece. The work closes with a representation of the strength, spirit, and faith shown by those involved in the mighty battle with the Red. Red River of the North, 1997, is dedicated to those hardy people.